Our speaker this morning is Alex Taylor, and he's going to be talking about A Journey of Surprises. And I'll read a short biography about Alex. Alex has an undergraduate degree in arts and a master's degree in divinity. In addition, he has postgraduate work in marriage counseling and counseling folk with addiction issues. He also has a certificate in labor negotiations from Queen's University. By profession, Alex is an ordained minister of the United Church of Canada, serving congregations in Ontario and Saskatchewan. Prior to retiring, he served for 13 years as the minister of Zion United Church here in Regina. Alex also served a short time in the Saskatchewan legislature, where he was minister of social services and minister responsible for the Public Service Commission. For 3 years, he served as the director of negotiations for Saskatchewan Health, and 2 years as chair of the Saskatchewan Workers' Compensation Board. Alex is presently a board member of the Regina Airport Authority and serves on its Human Resources Committee and chairs the Community Consultative Committee. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you, Andrew. First of all, I want to say thank you for the opportunity of being with you this morning and sharing some thoughts. It's always a privilege to be able to meet with others and share some ideas. Whether they're accepted or not doesn't really matter as long as you have the chance to share them. I want to tell you that if things go well this morning, I'll take the credit. If they don't, blame Jim. He's the one who invited me. And it's dangerous anyway, because he said he wanted me to talk something about what brought me to where I am and what happened along the way. And the other thing that's really dangerous, he did not give me a time limit. So you can really blame him. You've heard the story, I suppose, about the two little boys, a Catholic boy and another, who were having a good time and sharing with one another. And the one little boy said, "Why don't you go to my church someday and find out how things go?" And so he took the non-Catholic to the Catholic church, and he explained to him, you know, when people went in, they genuflected, and this was because of their belief that the altar was sacred, Christ was present, and it was an honor thing. When it came time for the priest to lift up the host, he explained what was going on. The little non-Catholic boy was nodding, "Yes, that's fine." And then the priest went to the pulpit, took out his watch and put it down on the pulpit, and the other little boy said, "And what does that mean?" And the Catholic boy said, "Not a damn thing." I should also tell you, my wife used to type my sermons for me. I would write them out, and this was in the old days of typewriters, and she would type them, and she always said that the shorter the notes, the longer I went. And it took me 6 pages of double-spaced type, 8.5 by 11, to go 20 minutes. This is all I've got today, so you're in trouble. I think it's important, first of all, that you know where I come from in terms of my thinking and my theology. Because I believe that theology is important for each of us. But I also believe it's important that it may differ for each of us. There are some who get really hung up on the details. As a Christian, I think of the groups that say, well, you know, the virgin birth, you've got to accept it as it was, literal. The others who say, no, it's a figurative thing that's teaching us a lesson. I'm not sure God gives a hoot about what we think of that, as long as we take the meaning that comes out of it. The same is true of some of our other concepts of theology. The Roman Catholics have a strong belief in the Pope and his role. The Anglicans have their 39 articles of faith. We in the United Church have the basis of union, and a lot has been added to that over the years, particularly at our last General Council. And we have different ways of worshiping. There are those who find worship in very ritualistic and ornate settings to be what meets their needs and what they need in order to fulfill their requirements. There's others who feel only comfortable in a very, very informal setting. My wife's family comes from a group called the Friends, and then they're very, very quiet and very almost a meeting type thing where they have their worship. And you know, I'm not sure, again, that God cares how we worship. I am convinced, though, that God cares what we do with our theology and what we do with our worship. It's important what arises out of it. And that's how I look at the statements of Jesus, "Love others as I have loved you." Or remember the story about the good neighbor. Who is the good neighbor? The one who does good, the one who helps the other. Jesus' love was a sacrificial love, in my view, one that gave everything for the sake of other people. And then the man called James, who was a follower of Jesus, says, "Faith without works is dead." I think that was a pretty blunt statement, and one that I've always felt was very true. Faith without works is dead. Now, I think the reverse is also true. Works without faith is dead, but that's time for another sermon. But faith without works is dead. There's a little poem that I came across a while ago, and it's just almost a cute little thing, but I think it's very meaningful. It was written by Marion Brown Shelton, and it says this: "When Jesus walked upon the earth, he didn't talk with kings. He talked with simple people of doing friendly things. He didn't praise the conquerors and all their hero host. He said the very greatest were those who loved the most. He didn't speak of mighty deeds and victories. He spoke of feeding hungry people and cheering lonely folk. I'm glad his words were simple words, his lessons ever true. The things he asked were simple things that even I can do." And I think that's very meaningful, because Jesus, in my understanding of faith and theology, calls on us not to believe, but to do, to go out and be that good neighbor, to go out and help. Now, I must tell you honestly that I don't like titles, and when Jim insisted that I give him a title for today, I did give him one. I don't like titles because often it takes me as long to come up with a decent title as it does to write a message, and it's a waste of time. And I think maybe instead of just surprises, the title could have been Coincidence or Holy Influence. And that's what I want you to decide for yourself. I'm not going to tell you what it was. And this is a first for me. I have never shared my sort of journey with any group before. So you'll forgive me as I stumble along. There were indeed many surprises on my journey. And the first surprise, of course, was when my parents made me sit down and said, "We're thinking of moving to Canada. How do you feel about that?" Now, I was an 11-year-old boy, and the idea of going to the country of cowboys and Indians, I mean, how else would I feel about it? I thought it was a great idea. And so we immigrated. But the next sort of surprise was, and I want to tell you that in terms of going into ministry, for me there was never a great flash or a sudden voice speaking. In fact, I've had some envy for people who can tell you that there was a day, a time, a moment when they knew for sure exactly that God had called them and this is what they were to do. That was never my experience. What happened was I was about 17 years of age, I guess, and teaching a Sunday school class of 22 six-year-old boys, which was a fairly interesting experience in itself. And one day the Sunday school superintendent said to me, "Alex, you have to consider ministry." And all he got from me was a great deal of laughter. I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I had ever heard. And I must say that apparently I wasn't the only one who felt that way. Just a few years ago, we returned to Scotland to visit the little village I'd been raised in during the Second World War, and visited with a gentleman and his wife who knew my family quite well when we'd been there. And he said, "I told my brother that you were coming, that you were a minister new." And he said, "Oh, wow, he couldn't he be?" So I wasn't the only one who was sort of thinking it was a ridiculous idea. For one thing, I was very happy in my work. I was a lineman with Bell Telephone. In fact, I was on the I was the lead hand on the crew that did the downtown work. We cabled, what I like to say is I cabled most of the high rises in Toronto, and then have to admit, in my day, the high rises were eight stories. But I enjoyed my work. I enjoyed what I was doing. But the interesting thing is that after that Sunday school superintendent said that to me, I never got it out of my mind. It didn't matter what else I was doing. I always was thinking, should I be going into ministry? And finally, I spoke to our home minister about it, and we talked for a while. Well, actually, a couple of years went on, and he would mention it to me once in a while, and I kept thinking about it. And finally, one day, he called me into his office, and he was a friend as well as the minister. And he said, "Alec, it's time you go or get off the pot." That's the way he put it. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, are you going into ministry or not?" And then he said he'd heard that the superintendent for home missions for Northern Ontario was looking for someone to fill in and do some work up there on a pastoral charge, well, a mission field, actually. He said, "Why don't you go there? And that's a way to test out and see how you work out and see whether you like it or not or whether you'll fit." And surprisingly, I said yes. And away we went. I went up to live in Cochrane, Ontario. I was 20 years old, had grade 10 education. Well, I had English and history of grade 12 that I'd taken at night school. No experience on church boards, no preaching. I had attended one funeral in my life, my aunt's, and suddenly there I was, the minister of six congregations, three I went to by road and three by train. And it was an interesting experience. My wife, Ruth, and I got married in March of the following year, and we stayed another year and a half. We spent 2 years altogether on that mission field, and yes, I came to the conclusion this was what I was supposed to be doing, except for one thing. After the 2 years, we knew that we had to make some decisions, and I was going to have to go back to school if I was going to become an ordained minister. And there was no way I was going to go to high school. And that would have taken another 3 years in Ontario's system. And I hated school to start with, so there was no way. So I kept finding excuses not to do it. And then a friend got hold of me and said, "Waterloo College, which was associated with the University of Western Ontario, has started a new system. If you pass their psych tests, they'll let you take a prep year. And if you pass that, then you can get into the regular arts program." Okay, that took one excuse away. And Ruth and I talked about this, and then we said, "Well, how can we afford it? We had a child by this time. How can we manage to pay for university?" And then the phone rang, and I was invited to go as the lay minister at the Holstein Pastoral Charge in southwestern Ontario. They would pay me and allow me to go to school at the same time. That took that excuse away, so away we went. Went to Holstein, and we had a great time there. They were a marvelous bunch of people and very understanding. But then came our... I got through the psych tests, incidentally, and nobody knows yet why. There are some who say they must have changed the test since then. I wouldn't make it now. Anyway, I got through the first year, the prep year, got into first year, and I think it was in our second year, Christmas came, and lo and behold, we didn't have the money to pay for our second semester. In those days, and remember this a long time ago, I think it was $210 or $220 for the second semester. If you have young people nowadays, you'll know that was a bargain. We didn't think it was a bargain. But we didn't have the money. And I thought, again, there's an excuse. I'll go back to the telephone company or to something else or do something else. And at Christmas, the clerk of session of the second congregation I served four of them, gave me the normal Christmas card. And I mean, this was a normal thing. We got home, opened the card, and lo and behold, there was a check in it for $200. We had not said a thing to anyone about having problems financially. So that took away that excuse. That was another surprise, and we were able to pay for that. The next year, when Christmas came, again, we had not the funds for the second semester. And the women's group, the UCW in those days, it was the WA of the Toronto West Presbytery, decided they had enough money, and they sent all of the candidates from that presbytery a check for $200 to help them with their studies. So again, the excuse was taken away. It seemed to us, at least, that I was trying to resist this ministry thing, and somehow I was going into it anyway. The excuses were removed. The surprises just seemed to keep coming. Moving from ministry into another area, when I was ordained, I came to Saskatchewan and went to the Etonia Pastoral Charge, which is up just the other side of Kindersley, and again, a great pastoral charge, and we've had a great experience every place we've served. We've always enjoyed it and had a good time, to be honest. But we went to Etonia, and things were going fine, and then about 1970, I got a phone call from a man called Ted, who said, I have someone here who would like to meet with you. Do you have time? Well, of course I had time. What else was I doing? So I said, okay, come on over. So Ted and this other chap came to the church office and sat down. And we passed the time of day, and finally this other fellow said, we would like you to consider being our candidate in the next provincial election. You know one's coming up. And again, I laughed. I thought that was a ridiculous idea. First of all, I had no political experience at all, no real background in it, and it was the NDP that were asking me to do this, and I knew that my area where I lived was anything but. In fact, when I did run and won the constituency, I lost my hometown 2-1, and that was the best we'd ever done there. So you have some idea. Anyway, I said, no, this is just not possible. I can't. I'm the minister. I can't be in politics. And Ted, bless his heart, said, Alec, do you remember before the last federal election, which was 2 years before, 1968, you preached a sermon on people being involved, and you said, if you have the opportunity, you have the responsibility. I said, Ted, I don't remember what I preached on last Sunday. Anyway, I felt when he said that I had no choice but at least to consider it seriously. I went to, Ruth and I talked it over, I went to the church board and I said, I've been asked to consider being a candidate, I didn't tell them for who, in the next provincial election, which we knew was going to be within a year or so. How would you feel about your minister being involved? And I knew that, boy, I mean, they were conservative. Anyway, I walked out of the room. When I came back, they passed a unanimous motion saying the minister had the same right as anyone else to be involved. At that point, I went home, talked to Ruth, and said, okay, we better do something. And we decided to go ahead. So I was elected in 1971, by 100 and some votes, not a huge majority, but at least they got there. And then after a year, I spent a year as the member, I became concerned because I was running back and forth and looking after a pastoral charge, and I felt it wasn't fair to them. So I was going to have to do something about this. It was hard to believe, but at that time, a United Church minister earned more than an MLA. That ain't true nowadays, I'll tell you. But at that time it was. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I gave up the pastoral charge, and it was just then that Blakeney called me into his office and asked me if I would join his cabinet. And I said, what department? And he said, social services, which is where I met David, incidentally. He came after me. And, you know, that was an exciting opportunity because it fit right in with my churches and my interests. You know, I said, faith without works is dead. Here was an opportunity to put some of that thing, that faith, that belief that you believed needed things that needed to be done, into practice. So I said, yes, Alan, I will join the cabinet. And I was able, I think, to get some things done that I could never have accomplished in pastoral ministry. And later, if you want to ask about them, I can mention some of these things, but I don't think they matter that much. It was the opportunity that was there to do something. Now, people would say to me from then on, why did you leave ministry? And I kept saying, I didn't leave ministry. I'm simply practicing it in a different forum. And I strongly believe that was true. And so here was another one of the surprises. Things happened just at the right time, because entering cabinet, I got an extra, I think it was $13,000 a year, and that made it easy for me to leave Etonia and to find another way of living. Then, of course, in 1975, I retired by popular demand. It was quite easy, actually. And I felt it wasn't fair to go back to a congregation. It wasn't fair to them to have a politician, recent politician, leading them. So we stayed out of ministry for a while. About 1982, we were starting to think, well, we'd been away long enough. Maybe it was time to just consider going back into ministry, because I still loved the idea of ministry. Ruth and I talked about it. We knew it would be a salary drop because I was working for the government, and that paid a heck of a lot more than the ministry did at that time. We were just thinking about that when I got a phone call, another surprise. I hadn't put my name in or anything, but I got a phone call from Milestone. Would you consider being our minister? So I went out, met with him. We hit it off. We went down and was ministry there for 6 years. So all I'm suggesting is that there were surprises all along the way, things that I can't explain why they happened. So the question is, were they coincidences, or was there a holy influence that was guiding and leading? Not in sense of predetermination, but just in sense of saying, this is where you need to be at this time. So that's sort of my story. I hope it's of some interest to you. And yes, I'm more than happy to take questions. So thank you very much for your attention.
Hi, my name's Ingrid, and I'm interested in what your story. It was quite amazing, and I'm wondering what changes you can remember that you were able to make when you were a minister of social services that you feel good about, and other, I hope they're still there, you know what I mean, to help particularly people who are living in poverty. And
well, the first thing that happened was that the first public engagement I had as a speaker after I was in the minister was to the Nursing Home Association in Saskatchewan. And of course the department was always very good, and David can tell you this, they'd write a speech for you and then get frustrated because I seldom used it, or at least I'd rewrite it. Anyway, the deputy minister went with me and I stood up and I made my speech, and in my speech I said, and as long as I am minister, there will be no more for-profit nursing homes in Saskatchewan, and we'll get rid of the ones that are here. When I stepped down, my deputy minister, Art Savon, said, did you talk to the premier about this? And I said, no. He said, well, what do you think he's going to say? I said, well, if he doesn't like it, he can fire me. As a matter of fact, the premier did like it, and we went that route. We got rid of most of the private nursing homes except for Extendicare. They and what we did was we provided some funding for nonprofit groups to purchase the nursing homes and operate them as nonprofits. Now, there's been changes since then. I think things have not gone all the way they should. But that was the first thing. The second was in the department developing the first, and not the best, daycare program. But it was the first provincial one for Saskatchewan. It left a lot to be desired, but it was at least a step in the right direction. And I think that has progressed since then. It's better now than it was then. It still needs a lot to be done, but at least it was a start. Two things that I was particularly proud of. One was the starting of the group called CORE, which worked very hard to move the disadvantaged from institutional settings to community settings. And Jack Funk, who I appointed as the executive director of that, did a fantastic job. He was not a bureaucrat and got in trouble often for not taking the bureaucratic way, but he started to empty our institutions and get people into group homes or into other settings. And so I was really proud of that. And the other was the family income plan, which for the first time in Canada ensured that people who were working could get assistance and be at least as well off as those who were not working and on straight welfare. That program has had its ups and downs since then. When we started it, and I must admit, when I first went to the department, I asked them to develop that program, and it didn't happen, and I finally went to a friend in the central agency and asked him to do it. It took me 3 tries at cabinet to sell it, finally sold it, and then went to the department and said, here it is, go run it. But one of its problems, according to the public, was that it was income tested and not means tested. It didn't matter if you had $1 million in land, you could still qualify, and there was complaints about that. I didn't think that was a major problem, but some people did. So there were some changes to it afterwards. But there's been some form of that has developed all across Canada since then in one way or another. So that was the other one that I was particularly proud of. In the Public Service Commission, I instructed the commission to develop a program where clerical staff could, with time off, with pay, take training so that they could train for administrative positions. This was particularly for the women, to assist them to advance in the public service. And we also instructed them to find a way of encouraging job sharing so that women could find their way after maternity back into the workforce. So that was some of the things.
What propelled your parents to decide to move to Canada, to the land of Indians and cowboys, at that age? What year would that be? And you went to Ontario first. Your ancestors weren't homesteaders then that came here to the prairies.
No, 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II. My dad had been in a steel foundry, and he was general foreman in a steel foundry, and he spent 24 hours a day there during a good part of the war. It had affected his lungs, so he was having to get out of that. So it was a time to look at something. Their best friends had moved to South Africa, and they were thinking of that. Thank God that didn't happen. And then he had a brother in a small town in Ontario who had just died, and he owned a restaurant, and they wanted somebody from the family to come and assist for a little while so that the son could get involved. And so we took that. Dad took that opportunity. That's why it ended up Canada. So we lived in a little town called Port Perry for 6 months and then moved to Toronto. Yeah.
Sorry, I was going to say something. I'm also an immigrant to Canada, and one of the choices my family had was between South Africa and Canada, too. It's interesting, though, like how environments do shape us, and I wonder what I would be if I was in South Africa, what you would be if you were in South Africa, and, you know, how much is it of ourselves? But with your mention of, you know, the land of cowboys and Indians, and I was thinking about the Truth and Reconciliation Committee or the reports that came out, and also with the 60s scoop of the children, and I was just wondering what your experience was when you were in government, and I assume that during the early 70s, mid-70s, that this was still happening. I grew up in Alberta. I remember one of my schoolmates was First Nations, and he was a problem child. And you kind of wonder, wow, what hurt did he have? And, you know, how did that affect him, the environments that we took him out of and into? And so I was just kind of wondering, when you look back at your time with social services, what did you see, or how did you see it, and how do you reflect on it?
Yeah, that was, it's difficult for me as I look back, because I can remember the chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations coming and talking to me particularly about adoption and fostering. And we wrestled, he and I both. And although he's out of favor now, it was David Ahenikew. And he had a real concern for his people. In spite of David's other problems since then, he really did. We wrestled with the issue, and David would say, look, you're putting our children in white homes. And my answer was always, find me Indian homes and we'll put them there. At that time, they didn't have the structure. It just wasn't there for them to develop these homes. So I look back now and say, we should have spent more time, more effort, helping them to develop these structures at that time. Although one thing David said always stuck with me, he could be very blunt at times, and I'd say, you know, the children could be killed if we don't take them away from a particular situation. And his answer at that point was, and he was being more facetious than anything, but he said, maybe some of our people have to die for us to finally realize what we need to do. And that was a bit shocking to me at the time, but I couldn't help later thinking seriously about that. But yeah, I think that was a failure of us. We did not meet the needs that were there at that time. All I can say is we were trying to do the best we could, but it wasn't good enough.
He snuck up on you.
Well, when you spoke of coincidence or holy influence, well, the coincidence, I don't think so, and the holy influence, I'm in no position to comment on. But what I wondered from what I heard from you was, what I took away was, if you lead a value-based life, and that those values permeate whatever it is you do, and you leave yourself open to the influences and opportunities that arise, good things can happen to you, and you don't stray off the path too often. Does that have any resonance at all?
Yeah, maybe it does. I have to be honest and say that I really was resisting going into ministry, because I didn't think I was the kind of person that should be a minister. Either of the crown or of the church. I was, you know, I did believe in this help, you know, reach out to your neighbor, do what you can. And so whether, as you say, it's holy influence or coincidence, I can't answer. Okay, well, thank you very much for letting me share with you. Mm-hmm.